Welcome to the Diabetes Podcast, where we cut through confusion, spotlight the science, and equip you with real tools to take control of your blood sugar for good. In today's episode, we're continuing our deep dive into Dr. Ralph DeFronzo's Dirty Dozen, the 12 core defects that drive type 2 diabetes. This episode explores one of the lesser known but critical players, islet amyloid polypeptide, or IAPP, deposition, also known as toxic amyloid buildup in the pancreas. This is about what happens inside your beta cells, the very ones responsible for producing insulin. And yes, they're under attack from the inside out. Let's break it all down. Normal physiology, what goes wrong, medications that may help, and finally, lifestyle strategies backed by science. Let's get into it. Hello, I'm Richie.
And I'm Amber.
And Amber, today marks the return to stuff that I don't know anything about. Today we are talking about islet amyloid polypeptide deposition, or IAPP deposition. So I am ready to learn. Can you please tell me about what amylin production looks like in a normal, happy pancreas?
Yeah, amylin is a companion hormone that is secreted with insulin. So when your pancreas releases insulin, it also releases amylin. And in a healthy body, it works to slow gastric emptying or delay the contents of the stomach from entering into the small intestine, helping you feel fuller longer.
So amylin under normal conditions is performing a lot of the functions that the GLP-1s are doing, specifically as it relates to slowing gastric emptying. Is that correct?
I think it's funny that you say that because you just basically said that a normal physiologic hormone is doing something that drugs do, which is really a backwards way to put it. Because no, that is the GLP-1 receptor agonist can mimic some of what it's an incretin mimetic. So it's mimicking in some ways what some of the things that amylin does. But to say it the way you said it, I would not.
Okay.
So some other things that amylin does in a healthy body is it can help inhibit glucagon secretion. And that's going to make sure that, you know, if insulin is present, the body has enough food, so it doesn't need your liver to put out more glucose.
And we talked about this in the alpha cell episode.
And it promotes satiety. So it helps you feel fuller longer. And really, to get this as basic as I possibly can, it helps to fine tune. So if you're on, you know, we're old, I can just say it. And we have the radio dial, you have the big tuner, and then you have the fine tuner. So it really helps fine tune post-meal glucose control.
Okay.
And in small amounts, it is extremely helpful. But in people with insulin resistance, the pancreas produces more insulin and along with that, more amylin. And that is where...
So I understand. So I can't secrete one without the other. Is that correct?
That's okay. Fair.
All right.
Yeah. And that's where things start to go wrong.
All right. So if I have high insulin, then I have high amylin as well. Okay.
Yep. And which sounds like it would be a good thing. High delayed gastric emptying, high satiety. That sounds great. But what can happen is when overproduced, amylin becomes misfolded because it's a polypeptide, which has a lot of bonds and it can become folded upon itself and really forms these amyloid plaques inside those pancreatic islet cells, specifically inside and around the beta cells, and creates a toxic buildup.
So if I understand correctly, it's kind of like knots in hair, right? Like
if everything's
laid out parallel, then you can run your fingers through it, no problem. I start getting some knots and some kinks, and now I'm having some a big mess is really what it is.
Yeah, and toxic buildup is the best way that I can find to describe it because it does damage the beta cell membranes.
Oh, wow.
And it can help, you know, we talked about these switches that can be turned on and trigger inflammation. It triggers inflammation. It causes programmed cell death of the beta cells.
Does too much amylin causes yes. beta cell, premature beta cell death?
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. And it accelerates the loss of, so, you know, if you have less beta cells, then you're losing insulin producing capacity, and it can help. Well, it's not helping. It accelerates that okay. loss.
Okay.
And what's interesting is, like, with Dr. DeFranzo, who, of course, we've been talking about, has the Dirty Dozen. He did this very landmark study with baboons 15 plus years ago. And they said that the deposits of that protein hormone called islet amyloid polypeptide shift the microenvironment of the islets of Langerhans, making it toxic to cells that produce insulin. So that was a very interesting way to put it. It's like bad soil trying to grow plants.
Okay.
So it's not just a symptom of type 2 diabetes, it really causes beta cell failure, and it contributes to the worsening of diabetes over time. And it begins well before someone is diagnosed with diabetes. It's in that hyperinsulinemia stage that this can come up with.
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. It seems like most every dysfunction that we've talked about so far is really beginning way before diagnosis.
Yes, that is right?
Like,
correct.
Like, yeah. If you got type 2 diabetes, God bless you, you're in a bad way. But, I mean, really, there's a far larger portion of the population that's probably dealing with this in some capacity. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
Like, the people that are affected by even just amylin overproduction far exceeds just those with type 2 or even pre-diabetes.
Yes. I mean, pre-diabetes is definitely there. And to your point, I think it's very telling and very interesting that up to 95% of people who have type 2 diabetes have detectable amyloid deposits in the pancreatic islet cells at the time of diagnosis. And what I find also interesting is this is very much like the amyloid plaques that we spoke to the last podcast when we were talking about brain insulin okay. resistance, that this folding and misshapening and having these amyloid plaques, it's happening in two separate areas, misfolding of proteins that's creating this.
In the brain, it was associated with Alzheimer's, correct? Is that?
Yes. Okay. That's absolutely correct.
Okay, mm-hmm. So very structurally similar dysfunction in two different parts of the body is mm-hmm. both kind of having devastating effects.
Yes, in the brain it's affecting memory loss and other things. And in the pancreas, it's leading to insulin loss. So okay. two diseases, yet one very destructive protein problem.
Okay. Before we get into medication, there's a blood test that I can do. We talked about for seeing if I got elevated insulin. Mm-hmm. Is there a separate one for amylin, or can we just assume if you have elevated insulin levels, you have elevated amylin levels?
Yes, you can okay. very much assume if you have elevated, because it's a co-secretor, okay. you can assume that you have elevated amylin levels.
So mm-hmm. the takeaway, get that test done, I think is the better to know where I'm at on this path to, if I'm on the path to type 2 diabetes.
Yes. Okay. That's a great call out there.
I had an anecdotal story. I talked to a friend of mine about this, and he showed me his blood work the other day. He was very, very proud that he was at the lowest level of insulin in the bloodstream with that fasting test. But he's a fairly athletic individual, particularly for his age group and all that kind of stuff. So I would be surprised. I know he eats pretty well and takes pretty good care of himself. But again, the word's getting out. People are actually going
That's
and
awesome.
Getting their fasting insulin done. So
that's so good to hear. Yay.
Could you tell me about the medications that help with this dysfunction.
Great. So there's no direct FDA approved drug that clears out or unfolds this misfolded protein, these amyloid plaques, if you will. Okay. And some, at least not yet, but some treatments, some medications can indirectly reduce that IAPP or islet amyloid polypeptide toxicity by protecting beta cells by lowering the insulin demand. And those would be your GLP-1 receptor agonists and then the uninjected, less powerful form of that on the other side are your DPP-4 inhibitors. So again, your GLP-1 receptor agonists can reduce the insulin demand by helping improve insulin sensitivity and really namely by decreasing glucagon. And it can reduce that. If you're putting out less insulin, then you're putting out less amylin, and you can enhance beta cell survival by having less buildup in the first place. And then your TZDs like pioglitazone, that definitely can help reduce insulin resistance and thereby potentially lowering amylin production. Then that leads us to pramlintide or Semolyn. So in a former, I see your face, in a former podcast, we talked about the Gila monster when we were talking about GLP-1s and how this class of medications came to be. And all of your GLP-1s were preceded by this medication, pramlintide or Semolyn. And this is an approved injectable, which is part of the reason why it's not very widely prescribed. But pramlintide or Semolyn is a synthetic analog of amylin. Okay. So you think, oh, that's great. However, the problem isn't that you don't have amylin. You know, it's rarely used in practice anymore besides when it first came out. As I said, it's approved both for type 1 and type 2 diabetes, but it requires injections. So usually it's recommended for breakfast and supper to be taken at those meals. It has a very high risk for nausea when people first start taking it. And there's a very strict titration. And just the fact that it's an injection twice a day, especially for people who have type 1, and they're injecting a basal insulin once or twice a day, and then usually just once a day, but sometimes twice. And then they're injecting their mealtime insulin 3 to 5 times a day, and then you're asking them to inject another drug twice on top of that. So Semolyn is more, probably would be more helpful to somebody who has type 1 diabetes because amylin can be deficient instead of overproduced as it's over secreted with insulin in type 2. But it has been shown to help with the post-meal blood sugars. But what it doesn't address is that toxicity. Mm-hmm. It doesn't unfold those polypeptide chains and that's basically it. It can slow gastric emptying. It can suppress post-meal glucagon release and enhance satiety, but it doesn't reduce the toxicity.
Okay.
And that's the main thing. It doesn't target that beta cell amyloid burden, that naturally secreted IAPP, and contributes to type 2 there.
Okay. So we know what drugs we can use. Is there anything that we can do better than the medication from a behavior standpoint?
We can lower the factors that drive the formation of this IAPP toxicity, especially when it comes to hyperinsulinemia, which is high levels of insulin in the blood, and oxidative stress. And here's how. You know, if you can do anything that reduces the demand for insulin, and whole food, plant-based diets have been shown to do that. So these are diets high in fiber, which would be 25 to 35 plus grams a day, high in phytonutrients, which are going to be your fruits and vegetables, will be very high in phytonutrients, and a low glycemic load, which is like the same thing as saying high fiber, non-starchy veggies type thing.
So just quick question, just so I understand. This would be favoring, I guess, vegetables more than fruits. I know normally we say we try and get, you know, 5-6 servings of fruits or vegetables. This is probably leaning more on the vegetables are going to have the lower, as it relates to this, the lower glycemic index as opposed to fruits and that kind of stuff.
Yes. I mean, most people do not get 5 to 9 servings of fruits and vegetables a day, which is recommended.
Okay.
Most people don't even come close to that. So if you're talking about fruit or vegetable, you're until you get to 5 to 9, you know.
I'm going to continue splitting hairs as long as we do this podcast, because I want to understand.
Yeah. Let's get to the 5 to 9, and then yes, it's more about non-starchy veggies, increasing those.
Okay, let me ask a very loaded but specific question then. Are there any fruits to maybe not gorge on?
Well, I would not define gorge. You know, I've heard people say my citrus is in, you know, we're in Florida, so they're like, my citrus trees are in, so I ate 3 or 4 oranges. So that would be gorging, I think. But for the most part, it's really hard to overeat. Of course you can, but it's a lot harder to overeat fruits and vegetables than it is
the fiber with the vegetables.
Because of the fiber content, because of the water content, it's a lot harder to overdo.
It's the orange juice versus oranges argument. Yeah.
I gotcha. Uh-huh. Okay. You can absolutely overdo it with juices. And,
Real quick.
Exactly. But another thing, you know, back to reducing insulin demand on the body, there have been some studies in rats and mice that suggest time-restricted eating could be helpful.
I think you talked about last episode as well.
No, I specifically did not, because I didn't feel like the human studies were strong enough.
Okay.
But in this, it really makes sense to give your pancreas a rest to help clear out some things to just not have the pancreas secreting a lot of insulin during certain time periods. And I think it would make sense to wake up, have a healthy breakfast, snack, lunch, you know, and have an early dinner versus eating 15 hours out of 24, you know, just kind of more constant. But it depends on the person.
Anytime you're talking time-restricted eating, there's a lot of flavors of how that does.
A lot.
Is 12 and 12, is that kind of the most benign in your opinion?
Yeah, that's a good one.
Because I mean, 12 and 12 or 10 and 14. People doing like 4 and 20, which to me, that's just way too much food in too short a time.
I agree with you. And it sets up disordered eating behaviors. There's a lot of nuance in that, because if you're basically starving yourself for the majority of the day, you're going to crave high fat, high sugar, and you're going to very likely overeat, make poor decisions about the quality of the nutrition that you have. So, I believe if you are set on doing time-restricted eating, I like the 10 and 14 or 12 and 12.
12 and 12. Yeah. And then again, add another layer to it, backing off 2 to 3 hours from bedtime, I'm assuming, just so that I'm not eating and then going to sleep right away.
Ideally, but I'm not going to sit here and be a hypocrite. I will not do that. And there have been plenty of times where, due to just sheer hunger, I have eaten before going to bed. Mm-hmm. And there's suggestive evidence that that's a no-no. But the truth is, the calories that you need are the calories that you need. And if I didn't get in enough nutrition throughout the day and I'm hungry before bed, I'm in tune enough with my body's hunger and satiety cues to listen. But again, with nuance, there are a lot of people who that's quite broken, mm-hmm. especially in insulin resistance. So getting the 5 to 9 servings of fruits and vegetables, getting enough fiber really helps with that hunger and satiety. And then you're not curious. Was I just emotional eating? Was it just the ghrelin and leptin levels that were off kilter and the hunger monster came out, or did I truly need it?
Or is insulin resistance affecting my brain? And now I don't have my normal hunger and satiety cues. So gotcha.
And then you can choose to spread the carbohydrate intake out throughout the day. So instead of a very highly concentrated carbohydrate meal once a day, you could just be mindful of the amount of carbohydrates you have at any one time and spread that out. And that typically will help with your postprandial glucose spikes.
Not to get too much into it, because I'm sure it's an episode. I'm assuming we're going to do an episode on macros at some point in time.
We're going to do a lot of episodes on a lot of stuff at some point. But our first, what we really wanted to tackle was normal physiology, what's broken with these 12 core defects, because too often I talk to people with type 2 diabetes and they don't understand how they got where they are. And they believe that if they just do this one thing, then it'll fix everything. And there's so much more to it. And I'm glad to have people start and do at least one thing to start somewhere, anywhere. Right. But to think that the denial is so huge around diabetes, and action is, people can get to where they feel quite helpless for so many reasons. Mm-hmm. For so many reasons. We're definitely going to have an episode on that, so I won't get into it. But it's just that during multiple stages of this disease progression, multiple things have failed and many things have not made sense to people, and they feel betrayed. Like, why wasn't I told that? Why didn't someone tell me that I could have numbness and tingling in my hands and feet?
That's why we're doing the podcast. I mean, literally, you know, I think it's safe to say you've talked to way more people at the end of their diabetes journey than at the beginning.
Yeah.
Right. Like, as a dietitian, as a diabetes educator,
yeah,
you're getting the people that are actively on fire, not the people that are playing with matches around a gas tank.
Absolutely.
So,
absolutely. The way that our healthcare system is structured, if you have access to medical nutrition therapy, to diabetes self-management education, you have to first be diagnosed with diabetes to get diabetes self-management education, which means you're behind the eight ball. You are already behind in the race. And it'd be great if I had people very newly diagnosed, and sometimes that happens, but most of the time people have had diabetes 6 to 12 years before I see them. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that there's no hope in that situation, but even when offered hope, it's not the first time that they've felt hope and then been disappointed over the course of the past decade or half a dozen years or longer. And it's heavy.
Yeah.
It's a lot. But that's, again, we're going to discuss that a lot more.
Sorry for the tangent. I just...
It's okay.
You know, I full disclosure, right? You've been in this field for over 2 decades now, almost 2.5 decades. I've been in this field as it relates to hearing you venting about what's wrong. But you know, this has been I'm just very grateful for the learning opportunity that this podcast has provided me to be able to better communicate, you know, not just with our clients, but just with people. I meet somebody with diabetes almost every single week.
Yeah.
You know, and I now have the opportunity to ask them, you know, is what you're doing working? Is whatever medication you're on working? And almost unanimously, it's no. It keeps getting worse.
Yeah.
So to have the opportunity to not just rely on the one or two people I meet during the week, but to be able to speak to the multitude of people that are currently being affected by this disease and will be affected by this disease. Like, it's in the mail. It's going to happen. You know, there's a reason that this thing is growing at a logarithmic rate in the population. I'm not sure exactly where I was going with that, but I appreciate this opportunity. This has been really, really eye-opening and really, really awesome for me.
Me as well. I enjoy it. So, just to get back on track regarding diet and the IAPP toxicity, it's hard to kind of come back. We went on a good little aside there.
My bad.
It's okay. No, it isn't. It's okay. I enjoyed it. So if you can eat anti-inflammatory and antioxidant supportive foods, that would be helpful. So we're talking about foods rich in flavonoids, which would be your dark berries, green tea, your really dark green leafy veggies.
This is your spinaches, your kales, that kind of stuff.
They can reduce oxidative damage, and your omega-3 fatty acids can help to support cell membrane integrity and reduce inflammation.
Okay. Exercise behaviors that help with this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So if you can improve, as we've talked about, I think, the past four or five at least
podcasts,
I think we say the same thing. Regular physical activity, especially your weight-bearing activities, and especially aerobic training.
Okay.
Aerobic and weight-bearing, those two. But if you're sitting on your Patushki 24/7, get up and walk. That is step one. And then you can graduate up to that level. In the last podcast, we talked about that quite a bit. Also, reducing excess weight, especially excess weight stored around your midsection and your visceral organs, because it's specifically excess fat stored around your visceral organs that creates that inflammation. And you know, it's sort of like inflammation is a hot word, but I've seen it used out of context way too often.
I know we've spoke a little bit to this in previous episodes, but, you know, I really want to hammer home when we say something like, try to lose a little bit of weight. My eyes almost roll back in my head at that point in time. Because like, it's just like to hear that so much, you know, I would take this opportunity just to speak to our folks and be like, look, you know, don't obsess about the numbers on the scale.
Absolutely.
Just start moving more.
Yep. Start limiting the intake of some of the dietary
recommendations that we've made.
Yep.
The weight will come down. It will come down. If I'm not gaining or losing and I start moving more and I just slightly start modifying my diet, my weight will move in the right direction.
I
hate saying try and lose weight because again, that's not prescriptive enough.
It feels very
enough.
Generic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Genetic. Generic.
Well, it's just, you know, we talked about how, you know, literally type 2 diabetes makes it more difficult to lose weight, makes it more difficult to specifically lose that visceral fat that's so toxic and so inflammatory. So, you know, again, I'm back on the soapbox. But, you know, for a population that's just been not getting a lot of wins, feeling beat up, you know, I would, you know, we end every episode with take courage. And the reason why is this is not an easy thing, but if you just do it and you do it consistently, it'll work. And it'll work every time.
And it's very, very important. And I emphasize pretty consistently that it is not just about the weight on a scale. Yeah. And we talked about this last podcast, that it is a lot more about body composition because the weight on the scale can absolutely lie. If I was in like the Biggest Loser competition, Horrible show, by the way. Sorry if you liked it. Sorry, not sorry. But if I could get $1,000 for helping somebody to lose 10 pounds in 5 days, I could absolutely do it.
Yeah.
I have no doubt that I could help somebody lose 10 pounds in 5 days. I can help somebody lose 10 pounds in 2 or 3 days. But guess what? They are going to gain it all back in two or three days.
Not just that. You're dropping lean body mass. Like that. That's the. I can drop lean body mass pretty quick.
What are you saying? Oh no. I feel that you're misspeaking.
Like the risk of hyper focusing on the weight bit is again, like more often than not, I'm losing the tissue that I want as fast or faster than I'm losing.
Absolutely. But if we're talking in a matter of days, we're talking about water. We're talking absolutely water and carbohydrate mass. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But okay. You, to your point, if it's over a month or two, absolutely. You could very much be losing lean body mass if not done appropriately.
Okay.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And you see that a lot in your GLP-1s, but that's a... So that's going off the side, following the rabbit trails. I could talk about this all day.
On the rabbit trail episode, it has been.
I enjoy it, but I want to make sure that we rein it in a little bit, you know, because we will have time to talk about that. We absolutely will.
Yeah, we are here to say, just stay tuned. We'll get around all of it. Matter of fact, I'll go ahead and take the time to plug email support@empowereddiabetes.com. You got questions, we'll answer them on the air. Like, we want to provide that level of feedback and that level of access. So that's support@empowereddiabetes.com. Send us your questions and we will answer them for you on the podcast.
Not until we finish the 12 core defects.
Well, yeah.
We have 3 more.
I get it. We're almost there.
It's okay. Hey, can you guess the other thing that can affect IAPP toxicity?
Probably sleep and stress, I'm guessing.
What? How did you know?
Because it's the same for every one of these things.
It is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because sleep deprivation can raise cortisol levels, can raise your stress hormones, and worsen insulin resistance, which indirectly can worsen that IAPP toxicity. Right. Absolutely. And just to bring home the diet and exercise portion a little bit more, that whole toxic process is amplified by the SAD system in the standard American diet: high fat, high sugar, overly processed foods combined with a sedentary lifestyle. So, in fact, studies show that overnutrition plus inactivity can increase islet amyloid polypeptide toxicity. So, even before the blood sugars go up.
I got a question, or really just a clarification. When you say overnutrition, I know that's a technical word. We're saying too many calories.
Right.
Right. Not like I have such a nutritious diet.
Yes. Okay. Very important. I know what I'm talking about. Why don't you know what I'm talking about? Well, Read my mind.
I'm here to speak for the layperson. And as a layperson, I have never had overnutrition in my life. I have never had so much nutrition in my diet that I was just rejecting all of those vitamins and minerals and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, that wasn't how I meant over nutrition.
I've had a surplus of calories mm-hmm. on occasion. Probably more mm-hmm. occasions than is appropriate. But I do not know that I've suffered from too much nutrition at any point in time.
That's fair.
So when we say over nutrition, what we mean is too many calories.
Too many calories, too much fat, too much sugar.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'd have to look at the studies again, but I think it's somewhere between 15 and 23 pounds of sugar that the average American eats in a year.
So less than that would be good.
Way less than
so,
that.
So what? We got to start somewhere. Let's dial it back to 22.
What? More? Maybe more. Let's go. Let's dial it back even more.
I could do 19 right now, totally comfortably.
I have no comment.
All right. Well, Thanks for tuning in this week. Again, we just appreciate the opportunity to speak to the multiple ways that this disease will eat your lunch if you allow it. If you do not adopt the behaviors that start to put this disease into remission. Again, sometimes in complement to medicine, but there is no medicine to replace the human need to eat good food and to move your body. That is it. And that's whether you got type 2 diabetes or not. That's always been a human need. And we're just starting to see really the downside at scale of what taking those two things out of a normal day does to a population. So again, thanks for the opportunity to talk to you again this week. And we will talk to you again next week.
Thank you for joining us. Have a fantastic week.
If today's episode sparks something in you, whether it's curiosity, clarity, or conviction, don't keep it to yourself. Share it with someone who needs to hear this. And if you're ready to go deeper, to get off the blood sugar roller coaster and walk a real path to remission with expert guidance and massive support, visit us at empowereddiabetes.com. Your healthiest life is waiting. We'll see you in the next episode, where we keep peeling back the science and stacking up the tools to help you put type 2 diabetes in your rearview mirror for good. Take courage. You can do this, and we can help.